Hi, everyone. Today I'm with Dr. Maitri. So I guess, would you first like to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Natalie Maitri. I am a physician and I'm a neuroscientist. And I, in my clinic, take care of babies who have cerebral palsy, along with other neurodevelopmental disabilities. And I take care and I do research to design new interventions to help them recover function.
Great. So, so today we're going to be discussing cerebral palsy and the relation of and the importance of advocacy in relation to it. So I guess just for people who are unfamiliar with it, could you please just quickly explain like what cerebral palsy is?
Sure. So cerebral palsy is the most common physical disability throughout the lifespan, not just in the U.S., but in the world. It's a disorder of impaired movement and sensation that is associated with many other problems. But the primary disorder is the result of a lesion in the period around the time of birth, either a little bit before, a little bit after, that causes a non-progressive disorder. So if you think about it, this is not like Alzheimer's, let's say. The lesion that happened in the brain near the time of birth, that lesion is not progressive. And so babies and children who have CP can recover function over time.
Oh, so something you're born with.
Just one second. My phone is going to switch over.
So it basically you're saying it occurs from birth.
Yes, that's correct. So cerebral palsy has many, many different causes or etiologies.
Yeah.
But all of them start in what's called the perinatal period. So around the time of birth, sometimes a little bit before birth during pregnancy, and sometimes a little bit after birth.
Mm-hmm.
We usually consider the time after birth, like let's say the month after birth. So it can include the time of birth as well.
Oh. And So then when talking about cerebral palsy, I know that there's many different types of classifications. So like what are some of the most common that you've, come in contact with a lot? And basically what's the reason for it being classified this way?
All right. So there are different ways that cerebral palsy can be classified. Some of it is due to the reasons why it originates. So sometimes it's due, as we mentioned, to a brain injury, so like a brain bleed or a stroke. And sometimes it's associated with a genetic problem, mm-hmm. or even a trauma. Sometimes it's associated with prematurity. So that's the first way that people think about cerebral palsy. What is the reason it happened? The second is how it looks. So there are different ways that we classify it. One of that is the way that the tone that the child experiences presents. So some children have low tone, some children have high tone, some children have a tone that keeps changing, mm-hmm. and they have these repetitive movements. Some children have problems with balance, and it's the coordination of movement that's affected. And so we have different ways of classifying that, but it can go anywhere from spastic, where the tone is usually high, to hypotonic, where the tone is low, to mixed types. And then there's the other, what's called dyskinetic, meaning that the movements associated with it are different. And that dyskinetic type of CP is primarily defined in that. And there are several categories, such as dystonia, dystonia and ataxia, chorioathetosis. There are many types mm-hmm. within that classification. So that's just describing the tone and the movement. And then there's another type of classification of cerebral palsy that describes which limbs are affected, how much of the body's affected. So I think you've probably heard of quadriplegia, four limbs are affected, mm-hmm. or diplegia, that means both legs are affected.
Okay. So it seems like there's a lot of classifications, very specific ones at least, depending on the condition that you have.
Yeah, there are.
So I guess now shifting, and now that we've sort of went over really what it is, and the way that it's sort of referred to and the types of it and the risk factors or causes, I guess from that I would like to shift towards more discussion of advocacy. So I guess obviously we can begin with, I know, would you like to explain, like, I know you're have an advocacy position on the scientific advisor, on the scientific advisory board of the Cerebral Palsy Foundation. So would you like to talk about, like, what the foundation is and what it does?
Sure. So the thing to understand about cerebral palsy and why advocacy is so important is this. The World Health Organization, and I'm sure you're familiar with this, and forgive me if I'm just repeating it. The World Health Organization has defined what's called the International Classification of Function in Health and Disability. So we don't just think of cerebral palsy as a disorder. We think about it in the context of that ICF, that classification, and how it affects not just body systems, but also the ability of an individual to participate in their community and their family, their environment, and how their environment can be adapted or maladapted to them. We also think about personal factors that play into this. And if you think about those can be social determinants of health, right? Yeah. So the reason why it's so important to think about CP this way is because when we advocate for more research or better clinical care, we're not advocating just for a disorder. We're advocating for improvement of an entire ecosystem. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I actually think that's sort of an interesting perspective, or a way to look at it is, and that's sort of, I actually think, when I think of advocacy, really what I like about advocacy is that it does take so many forms, whether it's fundraising, awareness, or lobbying. And I actually think that because of your perspective of it, or how the World Health Organization defines it, makes cerebral palsy a very specifically like a disease and disorder that can be very benefited from increased advocacy efforts and creating a community that's
absolutely
creating a community that's more, again, for lack of a better word, aware and conscious and. So I guess when you work for your Cerebral Palsy Foundation, so what does that organization like specifically do?
So this is an organization whose primary purpose is actually knowledge translation and dissemination, mm-hmm. as well as stakeholder engagement. So they're not like the NIH, right? The NIH, for example, the National Health Institute, is an organization whose primary purpose is to fund progress in science and mm-hmm. research, right?
Yeah.
But when you work with a foundation like the Cerebral Palsy Foundation, what you're really focusing on is interactions with stakeholders, and they're incredible at that. They have a connection to their community that allows them to say, what do you need from all these scientists, doctors, researchers, right? Mm-hmm. What do you need from the government? What do you need from these people? What are your priorities? And then also translating those back to us, but also letting us disseminate our knowledge in a way that's accessible to the community of stakeholders. So it's a dual role. And that's why advocacy becomes so important, because they have advocates at the level of, you know, various governmental organizations, but they are also this entire organization that's an advocate for their stakeholders. So there are very different ways, right? And you mentioned mm-hmm. some of them, of being an advocate. And I think one of the ways they help is by saying, okay, let's all get together, all organizations who care for children with cerebral palsy and adults with cerebral palsy, and let's lobby the government to be more aware that this is a problem, mm-hmm. that we need to invest research dollars in it, but also build better communication between clinical and community systems, things like that, right?
Yeah.
So they could do that, but they also advocate for their stakeholders through all their various channels, including social media, public schools, and the foundation then says, all right, tell us, you know, not just what matters to you, but let's say a scientist has an idea and says, all right, I want to see how important sleep is to people with cerebral palsy. Mm-hmm. And then the foundation would go and ask their stakeholders, well, not just how important is it to you, how much do you know about it? And also, how do you think it affects your life or your child's life with cerebral palsy? And then, even more importantly, if we're designing treatments, what is your preference? Would you prefer they be patient or parent administered? Do you prefer to work with a therapist? Do you prefer to work with medications? Would you like surgery? And so they get to rank their orders of preference for what they want. And that is a different kind of advocacy, right?
Yeah,
which
wow.
is listening to your stakeholders and bringing them back to the medical and scientific community and saying, listen to what they're saying. And don't go designing something, another surgical intervention, to fix something. That's not what these people want. They're actually interested more in these types of intervention.
That's actually really interesting, because I've worked with a lot of organizations in medical advocacy, and that's a very, you know, I would think that organizations would rely on that more, rely on what communicating with the actually afflicted community. And I think that's a really unique thing, because I don't know of many organizations that specifically do that. And I think that's a really interesting way.
So they also have to be really good at knowledge translation and dissemination, right? Mm-hmm. So because to communicate well with their stakeholders, they have to act as sort of these translators between medical and clinical and government and all sorts of and research communities, to try to get them to put things in ways that would make a difference. Mm-hmm. I don't know if, do you see what I mean?
Yeah, and I think that sort of goes in line with what Discuss Med sort of focuses on, and what, you know, interviewing you and other doctors is all about. Trying again then to then make it more towards, again, somewhat more away from the afflicted, but also the general population, specifically the youth, which tend to be a little harder to reach specifically, and sort of again then, you know, again making it more accessible and simplifying terms that they might be unfamiliar with. So I actually think that's sort of something that resonates, like, I'm completely aware of, and I think that's something that's so important, because science is confusing, especially when you give them a bunch of random names of molecules and results. And I think by able to simplify, I think that's such an important goal. And sort of going on that, I definitely want to bring another goal of discussion, talking about, like, encouraging youth advocacy. And I just want to ask you, like, in your opinion, why do you think, like, it's so important to get youth involved specifically, rather than just, like, the parents?
So, you know, we know that what makes someone passionate and invested and persistent throughout the hard times is personal experience. And so one of the things that is so critical about advocacy is that usually it is tied to knowing someone, to caring about someone who either has a disease or working with them, and getting to know them, forging the personal connections that will sustain them through the challenges of what it's like to advocate for things that, I mean, you know as well as I do, it's tough. And so creating that passion early lets it snowball and become this enormous force, which later on in adulthood and older adulthood is still there. And by then, it's acquired this importance, and it's very hard to derail someone who started early in their youth as being an advocate. By the time they reach adulthood, nothing is going to get in their way. And I guess I work in development, and so we know that from the work of James Heckman, won a Nobel Prize in economics, right? Mm-hmm. He said interventions, especially for those who are the most disadvantaged, is early learning interventions that start, the earlier they start, the larger the return on investment in adulthood. And it's very much the same for advocacy. If you start getting involved early and you connect early to the individuals whose lives you're trying to change, then it just creates this enormous snowball and return on investment, this trajectory that later on is very hard to derail. it's lovely to hear that you do this and that you encourage others to do it, because now is the time to do it. When you're young and you have all this passion and energy, and let it build so that by the time you're an adult, people who are trying to rain on your parade and tell you it's not possible are not as likely to derail you.
Yeah. And I think the snowball metaphor, I actually thought that was a really good one. I think that really encapsulates it very well in the idea that, you know, you sort of pick up this passion, pick on this power of, like, you know, determination and ambition. I think that resonates well, and I think that's something that we really try to do, is sort of then, because I know, you know, like, the Cerebral Palsy Foundation and the work you guys do is all about, you know, again, taking it from the clinical data and the research and, you know, the government and all that, and then basically serving as the bridge to the general population or any afflicted communities. And then what I try to do, and I think it's sort of, and I think they capture it well, is then take another bridge to then the youth specifically, who tend to be, you know, when I first worked for the American Cancer Society, I did a lot of advocacy for them. I found that the youth, you know, there's a lot of volunteers, but in terms of the youth, not so many. And that's sort of what motivated me in the first place to create an organization like this, seeing the apathy that's so widespread and prevalent in this youth population. Or, like, from at least
that side. It's not all their fault, so you know. I think it's amazing that you're doing that. But you need to find the right partners. You need to find people who see all these youth and say, you are worth supporting. You know what? You are full of energy and you are full of passion. And I understand that you're young and that you don't know a lot yet, but I value your passion, I value your energy, and let me help you channel it. Yes. There's a fantastic song by Cat Stevens. I don't know if you know it. It's called Father and Son.
No.
Listen to it sometimes. it's a really cool song that encapsulates all of that, and just know that it's wonderful that you're doing that, but make sure that you partner with the right organizations, the right people, the right adults who will value what you all have to offer and see it as the priceless treasure it really is.
Yeah, and it's definitely really helpful interviewing people like you who are very also passionate and have gone through this path, and are still very heavily involved. So I definitely don't want to take any more of your time, but I greatly appreciate you speaking with me today. And, you know, I think that it'll actually have, I hope anyone listening to this would be inspired by what you had to say and the metaphors. And I think what you had to say is actually really interesting and motivating in terms of trying to get started and advocate for something that I feel like cerebral palsy is a disease that, like, a disorder that often doesn't get as much attention as others. And I think that giving it can help that, you know.
Which is kind of crazy because it's actually, like I said, the most common physical disability throughout the lifespan.
Yes.
And so, yeah, if you have any young people interested in advocating or in learning more about it, there's always a place at the Baby Brain Optimization Project with us.
Mm-hmm.
And we have lots of summer interns. We have every walk of life, some with disabilities, some without. We welcome you all.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Maitri. I had a great time speaking with
you're
you.
You're very welcome.
And have a good day.